I could tell at once it was inflammatory writing against Germany. Helmut's ears fill up, as though he's underwater. Mussner looks at Helmut, and when he speaks, his words sound underwater, too. Your friend is a good German who only wants to do his duty. He continues to read from Duver's statement. At home, I locked the paper in a box because I wanted to gather evidence so that at the right time I could denounce Hubner. The word rings in Helmut's ears. Denounce, denounce, denounce. Mussner continues reading. I realized that I was wrong, and I now fall under suspicion for having cooperated with Hubner. This is not the case, however, and I want to clarify that I merely wanted to collect evidence against Hubner. Mussner stops, clasps his hands together, rests them on the desk. Have you anything to say? Helmut's heart sinks as he realizes that Duver denounced him in order to save himself. You'll admit to anything to stop the pain. That's what Brother Vorbs had said. What did the Gestapo do to Duver? Helmut sees Karl's grinning face, Rudy's worried face. He feels their hand, three hands, one atop the other, shaking on their promise. Agreed. No names. I'm ready to confess, says Helmut. I take full responsibility. Later, the black Mercedes carrying Helmut threads through the Hammerbrook streets. Helmut prays Oma isn't home so that she won't see his bruised face. But she is home, and she cries out and rushes to him, reaching for him. Helmut, what have you done? Wangerman thrusts out his hand, stops her, says, Official Gestapo business. We are looking for enemy propaganda. Enemy propaganda, says Oma. We don't have any. Opa guides Oma to the sofa, saying, Quiet, dear. Let them look. They'll see they are mistaken, that all this is a terrible mistake. Oma clutches her apron, wrings it, weeps loudly. Opa draws her to him, a stricken look on his face, and Helmut can't watch anymore. He points to the closet, his bedroom, says everything can be found there. But the two agents ransack the apartment anyway. Oma whimpers as they empty drawers, lift mattresses, peeling wallpaper for secret hideaways. In the end, they find all the incriminating evidence just where Helmut said. The Rolla radio, a pile of assorted leaflets, notebooks, manuscripts of handbills, shorthand notes, and the Remington typewriter with seven carbon sheets of paper stuck between the carriage rollers. Such interesting reading, says Mussner sarcastically, leaning over the typewriter. It says, Who is inciting whom? He reads a section out loud. All accusations against the American government lack any truthful basis. They are fabricated, malicious, and remain symptoms of the deepest hatred. Wangerman glares ape-like at Helmut. So you think der Führer is a liar? Helmut wants to shout out, Yes, he is a liar. But instead he clamps his mouth shut, steels himself, prays Wangerman won't hit him, not here, not in front of his grandmother. You disgusting piece of trash, says Wangerman. He pushes Helmut out the door, out to the street. Oma wails behind him, and as he ducks into the car, he looks up, sees her glistening face at the window. 8 p.m. A green prisoner van transports Helmut to concentration camp Fuhlsbüttel, to the north of Hamburg. A guard takes his trousers, his shirt, his shoelaces, and hands him a pair of blue prison pants and shirt, leads him to a holding cell. Helmut looks around the putrid cell, an overflowing slop bucket in the corner, a cot with no mattress, just boards, a single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Somewhere he hears a scream, sobs. He sits on the bed, swings his legs over the edge of the cot, lies down. He folds his arms across his chest for warmth, closes his eyes, tells himself the worst is over, he's confessed. He kept his promise to Rudy and Karl. Tears swell, and then come in great heaves of relief. Helmut sits on the floor beneath the window in a square of sunlight. He can barely breathe when he thinks what lies ahead. He focuses his mind, doesn't want to be numb, wants to think, to feel. He listens to the sounds of prison. From the hall, a metallic clattering sound, doors opening, doors closing. From another cell, sobs. From a passing guard, footfalls. From the prison yard, the tramp of feet. From the city, sirens. The square of sunshine moves, diffuses, grows faint yellow. Helmut feels lost in a dream. Carl and Rudy enter the dream. Their faces float in front of him, then fade out and enter again, first one, then the other, and then the three of them together. Morning. The slot opens. A cup of brown liquid and a hunk of dry bread. Helmut gulps the liquid, gobbles the bread. He can no longer avoid the overflowing slop bucket. Later. Footsteps. Outside the cell door. Helmut stands in anticipation. The slot slides open. Eyes meet his. The slot slams shut. A key turns in the lock. A rasping, grating sound, metal against metal. The door swings open. A guard looms in the open door. "Out," he says, motioning with the rubber truncheon. "Back to police headquarters with you." Helmut falters. "But I've already confessed." The guard's mouth tightens. Wham! His truncheon strikes Helmut in the stomach so fast he doesn't see it coming. It doubles him over, knocks the wind out of him. Helmut groans, clutches his belly, the sour taste of vomit. He swallows it down. "Guess you didn't tell them enough," says the guard. "Hands on head." It stabs to stand up straight. Helmut clasps his hands on top of his head, walks, elbows sticking out like wings. He plods down the corridor, outside to the transport van. Gestapo headquarters. Helmut awaits his turn for interrogation in a room painted a brilliant, dazzling white and brightly lit with large lights. It's called the Hall of Mirrors. A Nazi joke, Helmut supposes, because there are no mirrors. All around, blue-clad prisoners stand at attention, noses 1 inch from the white wall, never moving, never flinching. 1 hour. Two. More. Helmut's legs ache. His stomach burns. He feels faint. His mouth is dry. Needs the toilet. Worries he cannot hold it. Doesn't want to think about the trouble that will cause. His name is called. The Gestapo interrogation room has a concrete floor. Round metal drains. A hose looped in the corner. Dark splatters. Dried blood? Across whitewashed walls. A lingering scent of disinfectant. In the center, a wooden table. Two wooden chairs. "We know you didn't work alone," says Vongerman, tapping his truncheon against his palm. "But I did," says Helmut. This time, Helmut expects the blows, the kicks, the grind of boots. The transport van carries him back to Fuhlsbüttel, where the guard clamps his hands and feet in metal bands, cuffs the bands to the bed. "For stubborn ones," says the guard. "You're a tough one. Most crack within 24 hours. Maybe you'll give a better answer tomorrow." Helmut lies spread-eagled on the boards. His face, back, shoulders, buttocks, legs, they burn, burn, burn. He prays not for deliverance, but for strength. He will not crack. Must. Hold. Out. No. Names. Another interrogation. Helmut gasps for breath. Each breath burns, his whole body feels on fire, and he cannot hold out any longer, cannot stop himself as he croaks, "Karl-Heinz Schnibbe, Rudi Wobbe." Helmut sits on the edge of the cot, head in hands, and sobs. Huge, racking sobs. He hates himself, hates what he has done. If only he held out. If only they had killed him. Helmut wishes he could kill himself. But how? He has no shoelaces, no sheet. He lies on the cot, stares at the ceiling, holds his breath, gasps, and gives up. Clutches his throat, squeezes hard, gasps again, tries again, harder. No use. And then he realizes. He can't die. He mustn't die. He must live. Live to take the blame. Live to save Carl and Rudy. The SS sit at a large table in the middle of the room, talking, laughing, shuffling papers. Helmut tunes out the guards, narrows his eyes to slits, blocks out the dazzling wall, stands nose 1 inch from the wall. Nothing phases him, nothing detracts him. He knows what he must do. The Gestapo are precise, methodical. The Gestapo don't make mistakes. Neither will Helmut. He has learned to do the waiting right, not to concentrate too hard, not to faint, not to attract attention, knows the terrible blows and kicks that fainting brings, knows not to drink in the morning, no matter how thirsty, because at the Hall of Mirrors, prisoners aren't allowed to use the toilet. And when it's his turn for interrogation, he will stick to his story, take all the blame for the radio and the leaflets, convince the Gestapo that Carl and Rudy were just curious onlookers, that Carl and Rudy are not traitors, that the leaflet campaign was all his idea. The Gestapo are precise, methodical. The Gestapo don't make mistakes. Neither will Helmut. He will do it right. If only he could warn Carl and Rudy. He squeezes his eyes shut. Prays. Suddenly the door opens and another prisoner is brought into the Hall of Mirrors. Out of the corner of his swollen eye, Helmut sees Carl. The Gestapo have made a mistake. Helmut nearly makes a mistake, too. He nearly calls out to Carl. It takes all his strength to swallow the words in his throat. His throat tightens, swollen thick with words. Carl spots him, too, and a stricken look crosses his face. Keep walking, keep walking, keep walking, wills Helmut, and Carl does. 10 steps, 6 steps, 3 steps from Helmut. And at that moment, that precise moment, their eyes lock. Helmut twitches the left side of his mouth, the slightest smile, winks his left eye, not enough to attract guards' attention, just enough to signal Carl. Carl blinks, hesitates, and then a flicker of understanding passes over his face. Helmut swallows hard, gulps down a sob. He's sure that Carl understands, sure that Carl knows that Helmut has taken the blame, sure Carl understands not to say anything that will implicate himself more during his interrogation. Helmut blinks back tears, wishes he could warn Rudy, wishes he could save them both from interrogation, wishes he could tell them he tried to hold out, wishes he could ask for their forgiveness. But there is no way to warn Rudy, and Helmut does not see him, or Carl, or Duver again until the trial 6 months later at the People's Court in Berlin. The infamous Blood Tribunal, the highest, most feared court in Germany. 6 p.m. A prison guard brings Helmut paper, a fountain pen, blue ink, for his final letters. The paper, the pen, the ink, they are sweeter than Mutti's plum kuchen. Helmut pulls up his stool to the scratchy table, spreads out the first sheet of paper, smooths it with his hands. He knuckles away tears. What will he tell his family? That he was foolish to think he could wage battle against such evil? No. Helmut does not believe he was foolish. He did not risk his life in vain. God can bring good out of evil. But God can't do it alone. God needs people, people who will stand up, people who will dare to speak out. For what has a man profited if he has gained the whole world and lost his soul? That's what the Bible says. Helmut feels something. His chest swells. A warm calmness fills him, and he knows that he has lived a life that stood for something. August 4th, 1942. Helmut leaves for Berlin. A guard handcuffs him, leads him to a green prisoner transport van. Helmut climbs inside, and his heart leaps as he sees Karl and Rudy sitting there. Gerhard Duver, too. Each boy is handcuffed to a guard, and so all Helmut can do is smile. And smile he does. They all grin at one another, all except for Duver, who casts his eyes down and stares at his hands folded in his lap. He cannot look Helmut in the eye. But Helmut waits for Duver to look at him, wills Duver to look at him, and when he does, Helmut nods and smiles. A mixture of shame and relief crosses Duver's face. "I'm sorry," he mouths, his eyes pained. "Me too," says Helmut with a nod. "Me too." The boys ride in silence. At the Altona train station, the guards herd them into a special train compartment marked Prisoner Transport, Entry Verboten. Once inside, the guards uncuff the boys. Rudy's guard says, "If I were the judge, I would give you boys a good thrashing, put you in uniform, and ship you to the front. Let the punishment fit the crime, that's what I say." Carl's guard nods, agrees, then points the boys to a bench seat. "Sit. You may talk, but I'm warning you, do not stand up and not one word about your case." The guards sit across from the four boys, take out a deck of playing cards. Helmut looks at Rudy and Karl. Hot tears flood his eyes. "I'm sorry," he whispers to them. "I tried to hold out." His guard shoots a warning look. "Not one word about your case," he says firmly. Helmut falls quiet. Karl cups his hand over Helmut's, squeezes. So does Rudy. The three friends sit there for the longest while, one hand atop the other. It is Karl who breaks the silence first. "Remember when I brought the false teeth to church?" he says. Helmut remembers and he laughs. For the rest of the trip, the boys swap stories. Moabit Prison, Berlin. Helmut meets his court-appointed lawyer, Herr Dr. Knie. He's a nervous man, wearing a crooked red bow tie and a Nazi party pin on his lapel. He spends the short time rifling through papers, asking simple questions, but not taking any notes. Helmut's heart sinks. His lawyer does not work for him. He works for the Nazi government. Nighttime. Another sleepless night. Helmut goes over the terrible interrogations again and again, turning each over in his head. Wants to be able to recall each detail so that he's consistent in his answers. August 11th, 1942. The People's Court. The four boys are hustled into the courtroom. Helmut wears the same clothes he wore the day of his arrest, 7 months ago. His trousers hang loosely, his white-collared shirt flutters about, so thin he has grown. It is the same with his friends, but they have been permitted to shower with real soap, and so they look scrubbed. The courtroom has dark oak floors, dark wood-paneled walls. Three blood-red swastika black banners hang from ceiling to floor, a large portrait of Adolf Hitler, and it's packed with spectators, mostly reporters. Murmurs ripple over the room as the boys enter. A guard uncuffs Karl, Rudy, and Gerhard, but Helmut is left cuffed, his hands chained behind his back. That tells Helmut something, that the justices have already decided he is the most important criminal, that he has committed a most serious offense. He feels nauseous. The more serious the justices consider the offense, the less likely that Helmut will be tried as a juvenile. Helmut looks around the crowded room, spots Herr Dr. Knie, Gestapo agent Musner, Heinrich Mohns, his boss from the Biberhaus, wearing his Nazi party uniform, Werner Kranz, the apprentice. Werner looks pained, as if dragged there by the scruff of his neck. Herr Schnibbe, Karl's father. No Mutti. No Oma or Opa. Helmut is relieved. He couldn't bear to see their anguished faces. At 10 o'clock, the tall wooden doors open, and the courtroom falls silent. At once, everyone rises as 7 justices enter. 3 wear blood-red caps and flowing red robes with a large golden eagle emblazoned on the front. The others wear stiffly pressed SS and military uniforms. There is no jury. The justices are the jury. The trial opens with a slam of the gavel that rings throughout the courtroom. One of the red-robed justices, Justice Engert, asks the boys simple questions, name, birth date, residence, occupation, and then reviews the charges against each boy, deliberate listening to foreign radio stations, willfully distributing newscasts of foreign radio stations, conspiracy to commit high treason. Chief Justice Fickeis takes over, barking out question after question, testing each boy's knowledge about Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. Bobe, what is our Führer's birthday? Schnibbe, what are the words to the Horst Wessel? Duwe, how many points in the Nazi program? Helmut gets the hardest questions. Hubener, what are the political aims for the Nazi Party? He answers each question sharply. Witnesses are called. Werner Kranz and Heinrich Mohns recount the events of January 20th, when Herr Mohns caught Helmut trying to press a leaflet into Werner's hand. Gestapo agent Mussner details each interrogation, word by word from his notes, saying things like, after lengthy remonstrations, and after emphatic admonishments, Hubener was moved to make a confession about the extent of his destructive activity. Helmut grunts at the words. That's what the Gestapo called beatings and torture, remonstrations and admonishments. The justices don't miss a detail from the boys' lives, their party record books, their school records, their Hitler Youth records. Even Rudy's Lord Lister detective card becomes evidence against them. Soon the questioning turns to the boy's crime. Justice Fickeis rehashes the same questions the boys had answered under interrogation. But there's a different edge to his questions now. Helmut concentrates, tries to put his finger on the shift. Slowly it dawns on Helmut. Fickeis is questioning them as adults. They are all being tried as adults, not juveniles. Hot fear spreads through Helmut. An adult conviction means much worse. A longer prison sentence or possibly the death sentence. He can't let that happen. Helmut focuses, clears his mind. He knows what he must do. He must keep the attention of the justices. He must convince them that he was the ringleader, that Karl and Rudy and Duwe were simply followers, no matter what. It's Helmut's turn. Chief Justice Fickeis takes out the pamphlets and flyers and clears the courtroom to protect the spectators from the enemy propaganda. The sight of the pamphlets and flyers enrages the judge. Why did you write these? He barks at Helmut. To let the people know the truth, answers Helmut in a loud, clear voice. The other justices fall deathly silent. He can feel Karl, Rudy, and Duwe stiffen next to him. But Helmut knows what he's doing. There's no other way. Do you really believe that the British are telling the truth? Says Fickeis. Absolutely. Don't you? Fickeis's face grows purple with rage. Do you doubt Germany's ultimate victory? Do you actually believe that Germany can win the war? Justice Fickeis is screaming now. Are you suggesting that your leaders are lying? Helmut takes a deep breath, and in the most contemptible manner he can muster, he says, Jawohl, ihr lucht. Yes, you are all liars. Pandemonium breaks out among the judges. Helmut's attorney snaps back, scowls at Helmut as if to say, Are you crazy? Helmut's insolence launches Justice Fickeis to his feet. He leans over the bench, purple with rage, You snot-nosed kid! What do you know about war? You're a scum, a traitor! He snaps the file shut, addresses Helmut's attorney. Is there anything else you'd like to say? Herr Dr. Knie argues that Helmut succumbed to the enemy propaganda because he was too immature to resist the temptation. I ask the court to be lenient in consideration of his age, says the attorney. That's enough, Verkeis glares at Helmut. Kubiner is no average boy. He brings another paper out of a folder. Helmut recognizes the paper. It's his graduation essay, The War of the Plutocrats. Verkeis rattles the essay at Helmut's attorney. This is the work of a person far above 18 years. This is no immature youth. The people must be protected from traitors like him. The fatherland is at stake. He replaces the essay, claps the folder shut, slams his fist down on top. This defendant acted with the thought and cunning of an adult. Consequently, he is to be sentenced as an adult. Without exception, this precocious young man has long since outgrown his youth. Justice Verkeis beckons to the other two justices. They hover behind the bench before drawing back to their chairs. We are ready for sentencing, says Verkeis. The courtroom doors swing open and the spectators fill their seats. Helmut's heart pounds against his ribcage as Justice Verkeis begins. The court orders the following to be sentenced, he says in a smug, satisfied voice. Hubener, for listening to a foreign radio station and distributing the news heard in connection with conspiracy to commit high treason and treasonable support of the enemy, to death and the loss of his civil rights during his lifetime. All around Helmut, the courtroom, the justices, the swastika banners explode. Red, white, yellow, blue streak his eyes, his knees buckle. The guard yanks him to his feet. He hears Verkeis pronounce, Vobbe, conspiracy to commit high treason, 10 years imprisonment. Schnibbe, 5 years imprisonment. Duva, 4 years imprisonment. The defendants are to bear the costs of the proceedings. Have you anything to say? Said Verkeis. Duva?
No.
Schnibbe?
No.
Vobbe?
No.
Hubener? Helmut struggles to regain his thoughts, to bring the pieces together. He points a finger at the justices. All I did was tell the truth, and you have sentenced me to die just for telling the truth. My time is now, but your time will come. The courtroom erupts in a roar. Shut up! Screams Justice Verkeis. Push him down! Shut him up! His gavel slams again and again. The guards leap upon Helmut, force him to his seat. His heart slams against his ribcage. He gulps for air. He did the right thing. He knows he did. Otherwise, the justices would execute them all. The trial is over. The boys are shackled and led to a small holding cell in the basement. A guard removes the handcuffs from Karl, Rudy, and Duva, but leaves Helmut shackled.
Helmut, cries Rudy, why did you do that?
Because it's the truth, says Helmut. He feels his eyes well with tears and he blinks them away. I did the right thing. I have no regrets.
They will reduce or cancel the verdict, says Karl. You're too young.
No, says Helmut. They will make an example out of me. A guard returns, says, Wolber, Schnibbe, Duer, get ready to go. You're going back to Hamburg. The boys surround Helmut, embrace him tightly. We'll meet again, says Karl. Goodbye, my friends, says Helmut. We will meet again. Helmut huffs the ink dry on the last letter. It is 8:05 p.m. He reads it again, wonders what his family will think, wonders who will tell Muti. He feels sad for Muti. He knows his death will be hard on her, for Oma and Opa, too, and Hans and Gerhard. He hopes his letters comfort them, bring them solace. the brusque pound of feet, the jangle of keys, the scrape of metal against metal. Helmut stands ready. He has made up his mind to go quietly with dignity and courage. The door swings open. Two guards enter.
Prisoner Hubner, come with us, says one.
It is time. The other shackles Helmut's hands behind his back. Helmut walks without stumbling down the long corridor outside into the courtyard. He draws in the crisp night air. It feels good. It smells like Muti's sheets on wash day. Above the tall red brick execution shed, between the leafless tree branches, the moon is full, opalescent. And he remembers a night long ago. Muti tucking them in. Three brothers. Three dark heads nestled against white pillows. White moonlight shimmering the walls. And Helmut is floating. Author's note. March 17th, 2004. It's morning. Soft gray light slips over the tall red brick wall that surrounds Plötzensee. It stretches across the exercise yard and reaches through the arched windows of the execution chamber. Inside, the light slants across the concrete floor. A vase of flowers and a single evergreen wreath sit where the guillotine once stood. I am standing where Helmut stood during the last 18 seconds of his life. I am standing where nearly 2,200 other men and women stood before they faced the executioner at Plötzensee between the years 1940 and 1945. Many of these victims were sentenced to death as enemies of the state because they, like Helmut Hubner, fought for human rights, political freedom, and truth. This story is a work of historical fiction. Helmut Hubner was a real person, and his character is based on extensive research, all filtered through my imagination, in order to create a dramatic meditation on what Helmut, his family, and friends lived through. In a work of fiction in which characters and events are based on real people and their experiences, it is natural for readers to wonder what really happened. We don't know exactly how Helmut spent his last day on Earth. To create scenes, I extracted factual details from his prison records and other primary sources. For other details, I relied on the experiences and writings of people who lived through similar experiences. We also don't know exactly what Helmut wrote in his last letters. No copies remain. But Helmut's half-brother, Gerhard Kunkel, remembers his own letter from Helmut. I was in Russia when I got Helmut's letter, Gerhard told me. I burned it, worried that it could get me in trouble. But I memorized the words. It said, I am very grateful to my Father in heaven that this agonizing life will shortly come to end this evening. I could not stand it any longer. My Father in heaven knows that I have done nothing wrong. I know that God lives and that he will be the judge in this matter. Until our happy reunion in a better world, I remain your brother in the gospel, Helmut. Helmut's arrest shocked Gerhard, who received the news at officer training school in Warsaw, Poland. It was like a ton of bricks hit me, said Gerhard. Here I was in the German army, and he's doing things like that against the government. It hit me hard. Gerhard was court-martialed. For 3 days I was squeezed, interrogated, said Gerhard. I never knew at any moment if they were going to take me out and shoot me as a traitor. The Nazis punished Gerhard for delivering the radio, condemning him as staatspolitisch nicht zuverlässig, or politically unreliable. They took my rank away, said Gerhard. I was a lieutenant, and they demoted me to corporal. Gerhard was sent to the Russian front as a forward artillery observer. He fought in Russia and later in Italy. Wounded 3 times, he received the Iron Cross, the Medal of Valor, and the Russian Battle Medal. For his actions, he earned back his rank and was released from the rehabilitation unit. The day after Helmut was executed, his mother, Emma Gudat Kunkelhubener, read about her son's death in the newspaper. She later received an invoice of expenses for Helmut's execution. 1.50 Reichsmarks for each day Helmut was imprisoned, 300 Reichsmarks for the cost of his execution, and 12 Pfennig for the cost of mailing the invoice. In late July 1943, Emma and her parents died in massive bombing attacks on Hamburg that killed an estimated 43,000 people. Shocked by Helmut's harsh sentence, many people wrote letters on his behalf, including his stepfather, Hugo Hubener. After the war, Hugo visited Gerhard several times. "I was surprised by how much he had changed," said Gerhard. "He brought us some wood so that we could have some fire in the stove and make some food. And he even came to church with us. He sat through all the sessions and listened to all the singing and the music. He was a different Hugo. It tells me that people can change if they want to change." Another letter was written by one of the interrogating Gestapo agents, either Mussner or Wongemann. The signature is illegible, but the letter writer describes Helmut as mentally uncorrupted and intelligent, but not mature enough to recognize the consequences of his actions. The agent argues that Helmut's graduation paper proves that he had a positive attitude toward the state and the Führer. The senior district director of the Hamburg Hitler Youth also wrote on Helmut's behalf, saying that Helmut served to the fullest satisfaction of his superiors. Another Hitler Youth official from the Berlin headquarters, however, claimed that Helmut's Hitler Youth record didn't matter. In a letter, this official argued for the execution due to the severity of Hubener's crime and the dangerous effect it could have on German morale during the war. Karl Heinz Schnibbe was sentenced to 5 years in a concentration camp, whereas Rudi Wolbe received a harsher sentence. For the lighter sentence, Karl credits Helmut's warning to him in the Hall of Mirrors. "He gave me a kind of wink and grin," said Karl. "I caught it out of the corner of my eye as I went in. At that moment, I knew that he had kept his promise." On their way to the trial in Berlin, Helmut apologized to Karl and Rudi for giving up their names to the Gestapo. "I'm sorry," Helmut told them. "I couldn't stand it, the torture, any longer." Helmut also forgave Gerhard Duver for denouncing him, saying, "I'm not mad at you. I know you could not help it." At the trial, Karl noted that the judges focused on Helmut and the leaflets, firing question after question at him. It was clear that the People's Court intended to make an example out of him. "Helmut realized he was doomed," said Karl. To Karl, that explains why Helmut purposely angered the justices with his responses, to save the lives of his friends. "To this day, I'm amazed at how cool, how clear, and how smart Helmut was," said Karl. "I believe he had made up his mind to conduct himself with courage and dignity." Toward the end of the war, as Germany needed more manpower, the Nazis offered Karl the opportunity to restore his honor by fighting for Germany. In return, he would be released from prison. Karl accepted, and he was sent to Czechoslovakia, where he was captured by the Russians and shipped to a prisoner of war camp in Siberia. The Russians released Karl in 1949, 4 years after the war ended. Karl emigrated to the United States in 1952. Helmut couldn't warn Rudi Wolbe, who implicated himself more during his interrogation, and to a prison cellmate who betrayed him to the Gestapo. Rudi was given a 10-year sentence, but he was released after Germany surrendered in 1945. He emigrated to the United States in 1953. Gerhard Duver received a 4-year sentence in return for his cooperation with authorities. Unlike Karl Heinz Schnibbe, Duver could not be inducted into the German army because he had trouble with his feet and limped badly. At the end of the war, Duver was released from prison. After the war, Karl befriended Gerhard Duver. "He told me he was ashamed about the way he denounced Helmut," said Karl. He apologized, and I forgave, just as Helmut had done. There's no reason to hold a grudge or to hate. If you forgive, you're forgiven. Carl explained his capacity for forgiveness. Who's perfect? Said Carl. Not you or I. People cannot judge. They have no idea how it really was, how the Gestapo will get information out of you. Fellow church member Heinrich Vorbs died shortly after his release from the concentration camp. It is unknown what became of Helmut's fellow apprentice, Werner Kranz, whom Helmut had approached to translate the leaflets into French. On May 12, 1950, Heinrich Mohns, the political overseer who reported Helmut to the Gestapo, was tried and convicted as a war criminal. He received a 2-year prison sentence for crimes against humanity, but his sentence was later nullified. Helmut's Oberbau teacher, August Mainz, described Helmut as a modest, diligent, likable student. But it was obvious to Mainz that Helmut did not agree with the principles of National Socialism. I could always observe his reaction, his eyes, when different things were discussed by the class. Many times I could tell he thought like me, said Mainz. But we never spoke about his thoughts or our thoughts. It was too dangerous. Still, when Mainz learned about Helmut's anti-Nazi activities and his subsequent arrest, he was plagued by one question. How did he come to the resistance? Wasn't it stupidity? He had to know that resistance was pointless. The teacher's question is one that Helmut's own brother, Gerhard Kunkel, has asked himself. I was angry at the Nazis. They could have handled Helmut a little different. He was no adult, he was still a teenager, Gerhard told me. But I was also angry at Helmut. He should have known better than that, being as smart as he was. He knew the laws of the land. A 16-year-old boy cannot change the government. Gerhard and his brother Hans emigrated to the United States in 1952. There are many reasons for a person to lie. But to have a reason to tell the truth, you must have a deep belief and great courage. Helmut possessed these things and held on to them even when the Nazis called him a traitor and sentenced him to death. Helmut Hubner is a boy who dared to speak out for the truth. Third Reich timeline. 1918. The Great War, later known as the First World War, ends November. 1919. The Treaty of Versailles is signed, June. The German Reich, known today as the Weimar Republic, is established as the official government in Germany, August. Today, most historians agree that the harsh Treaty of Versailles helped create the conditions responsible for Hitler's rise to power. 1923. Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers are arrested for attempting to overthrow the Reich, November. 1924. Hitler is found guilty of treason. From his jail cell, he pens a propagandistic and political autobiography, Mein Kampf. Hitler released from jail, December. 1925. Adolf Hitler begins to rebuild the Nazi Party. March. 1926. Hitlerjugend, Hitler Youth, officially formed. 1933. Hitler appointed Chancellor, January. Reichstag building burns, and Marinus van der Lubbe arrested for arson, February. Today it is hard to determine who set the fire, the communists or the Nazis, but it is agreed that Hitler used the event as a pretext to eliminate political opposition and to frighten the German people into casting their votes for the Nazi Party. Enabling acts grant Hitler dictatorial powers, March. Nazis boycott Jewish stores and businesses, April. Nazis burn un-German books, May. The People's Radio is unveiled at the 10th Radio Exhibition, August. 1934. Von der Lubbe is executed for setting fire to the Reichstag, February. President Hindenburg dies, and Hitler becomes Führer. August. 1935. Hitler initiates mandatory Reich labor service for young people and begins to rearm Germany. Nazis pass the Nuremberg race laws against the Jews, stripping them of all political and civil rights. The race laws identified a Jew as anyone who had 3 or 4 Jewish grandparents. September. 1936. The Gestapo are placed above the law. February. German troops reoccupy the Rhineland. March. Summer Olympic Games are held in Berlin. August. The Hitler Youth Law makes membership compulsory for all eligible youth ages 10 to 18. December. 1938. Germany annexes Austria, March, and the Sudetenland, November. Nazi orchestrated riots against Jews, Kristallnacht, take place all over Germany, killing 236 Jews, burning 1,300 synagogues, vandalizing and destroying more than 7,000 Jewish shops, businesses, schools, and private homes, and arresting more than 30,000 Jews, many never to be seen again. 2 days later, the Nazis ordered the Jews to pay 1 billion Reichsmarks, about $400 million, as punishment for a Nazi official's death. November. 1939. Hitler threatens Jews during speech to Reichstag. Germany annexes Czechoslovakia, March. Hitler toughens Hitler Youth Law, conscripting remaining eligible youth, March. Hitler Youth membership now totals more than 7 million boys and girls. Hitler and Stalin create the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact, August. On August 31st, the SS dress in Polish uniforms and launch a fake attack on a German radio station in southwest Poland. The next day, Adolf Hitler lies, claiming that Polish soldiers fired upon German soldiers, and he orders the invasion of Poland. England and France declare war on Germany. September. Poland falls. September. The extraordinary radio law is passed, making the intentional listening to enemy propaganda an offense punishable by death. September. The first deportation of Jews to concentration camps in Poland. October. 1940. British bombing raids begin over Hamburg. Nazis begin Battle of Britain bombing campaign. July. Germany conquers Denmark, Norway, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. 1941. Rudolf Hess, the third highest-ranking Nazi, deserts and flies secretly to England to negotiate a peace agreement. May. Greece and Yugoslavia fall to Germans. Yugoslavia, Greece, Bulgaria, Italy, and Romania join Nazis. Germany invades Soviet Russia. June. German Jews must wear Jewish star. September. Mass murder of 33,000 Jews at Baba Yar in Soviet Russia. September. Germany declares war on the U.S. December. 1942. Nazis hold Wannsee Conference to formalize plans for the final solution of the Jewish problem. January. German army lays siege to Moscow and heads toward Leningrad. October. 1943. Germany suffers a major defeat at Stalingrad. January. Allies carpet bomb Hamburg, killing at least 43,000. July. 1944. Allied troops launch D-Day invasion. June. 1945. Germany collapses as Allies invade. February to April. Hitler commits suicide in his bunker, but the Nazis lie, telling the German people that Hitler was killed at the head of his troops while defending Berlin. April. Germany surrenders, unconditionally. May. This is David Aykroyd. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Boy Who Dared by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Sean Runette. Text copyright 2008 by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.